KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
This decision means that states can essentially target women who are on Medicaid, poor women, and cut off their access to all forms of reproductive health care, including contraception and STI testing.
The Supreme Court backs South Carolina in defunding Planned Parenthood by removing its health clinics from Medicaid. This comes 3 years after the court overturned Roe v. Wade. We'll speak to Rebecca Grant, author of Access, Inside the Abortion Underground, and the 60-year battle for reproductive freedom. Then to the case of Andre Jose Hernandez Romero, a gay makeup artist and asylum seeker from Venezuela, who spent over 100 days locked up in El Salvador's mega prison, SECA, after being sent there by the Trump administration. We'll speak to his mother.
Andre last called me on March 14th at 6:30 in the afternoon, telling me he was coming home, that they were going to transfer him to another detention center in Texas, where the plane was going to bring them to Venezuela. The plane was carrying all of the other innocent young men, but the plane didn't come here. It was sent to El Salvador.
We'll also speak to Andre's best friend, who just tried to see him in El Salvador, but was barred, and to Democratic Congressmember Pramila Jayapal. Then we remember Bill Moyers, the legendary PBS broadcaster and former White House aide, has died at the age of 91.
Well, the consensual seduction of the mainstream media by and with the government is one of the most dangerous toxins at work in America today.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Doctors in Gaza say Israeli attacks have killed at least 72 people over the past 24 hours. Among the dead, 6 people killed by Israeli forces near an aid distribution point north of Rafah, operated by the militarized U.S.-Israeli-backed Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Meanwhile, Gaza's health ministry reports some 17,000 Palestinian children are suffering from acute malnutrition and are at risk of death. This is Mohammed Tabasha, a doctor in Gaza City, who says Israel's blockade of humanitarian aid, including milk and infant formula, is causing babies to starve.
The lack of milk affects the baby's weight. The baby does not grow fast, and hunger may affect the immunity of the baby, whereby one could easily become infected. And if his immunity is not strengthened, we may lose some babies due to a lack of available milk, especially the specialized formula that is no longer available from the health ministry.
On Capitol Hill, senior intelligence officials held a classified briefing Thursday for all 100 senators about President Trump's airstrikes on Iran's nuclear sites. Notably absent from the briefing was Trump's Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, who told Congress in March the intelligence community, quote, continues to assess Iran is not building a nuclear weapon, unquote. Last week, Gabbard walked back that assessment after Trump said she was wrong. Connecticut Democratic Senator Chris Murphy spoke to reporters after emerging from Thursday's closed-door briefing, warning Iran remains capable of rapidly producing a nuclear weapon.
You cannot bomb knowledge out of existence. No matter how many scientists you kill, there are still people in Iran who know how to work centrifuges. And if they still have enriched uranium and they still have the ability to use centrifuges, then you're not setting back the program by years. You're setting back the program by months. The only path forward is diplomacy.
On Thursday, the White House said U.S. diplomats had no plans to meet their Iranian counterparts, walking back Trump's claims a day earlier of a meeting scheduled for next week. The White House says it's reached an agreement with China to speed imports of rare earth elements as the Trump administration seeks to unwind its trade war with Beijing. Earlier today, China's Commerce Ministry confirmed it had agreed to the framework of a new deal that'll see the U.S. drop restrictive measures in exchange for access to minerals used in cars, semiconductors, and smartphones. Senate Republicans are scrambling to save President Trump's massive package of tax cuts for the wealthy and cuts to social programs, dubbed the One Big Beautiful Bill Act. On Thursday, the Senate parliamentarian ruled Republican efforts to change how states can tax Medicaid providers makes the legislation ineligible for passage by a simple majority. The ruling opens a door to a filibuster by Democrats. In a 6-3 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court has sided with South Carolina to defund Planned Parenthood by removing its health clinics from the state's Medicaid program. Writing for the dissent, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said the ruling's, quote, likely to result in tangible harm to real people. She said, quote, it will strip those South Carolinians and countless other Medicaid recipients around the country of a deeply personal freedom, the ability to decide who treats us at our most vulnerable, unquote. We'll have more on this ruling after headlines. Separately, the Supreme Court stayed the execution of a condemned Texas prisoner Thursday, mere minutes before he was scheduled to die by lethal injection. Ruben Gutierrez insists he was wrongfully convicted of a 1998 murder in Brownsville, Texas. He'll now have a chance to obtain DNA testing that he says will prove his innocence. Advocates are condemning widespread racial profiling as Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, continues to carry out mass raids nationwide, with mounting cases of U.S. citizens being rounded up as well. In Los Angeles, the family of Andrea Velez, a U.S. citizen, described her arrest by ICE earlier this week as a kidnapping. Velez had just been dropped off at work by her mom and sister when the pair witnessed masked federal agents grabbing and taking Velez in an unmarked car during an immigration raid. One video shows a masked agent lifting Velez from the ground and carrying her away. Velez's sister, Estrella Rosa, spoke with CBS News Los Angeles.
They didn't have a vest that said ICE or anything. Their cars didn't have license plates. Just because of the color of our skin, they think that we're criminals. My sister was there, so they she looks Hispanic, so let's take her too.
Andrea Velez was released Thursday on bond, accused of attempting to prevent an ICE arrest. In a similar case, Adrian Andrew Martinez, a 20-year-old U.S. citizen from the Los Angeles area, has been released from federal detention after he was violently arrested in a Walmart parking lot last week. Martinez was taken when he approached a group of heavily armed and masked federal agents who were detaining a Latino janitor at the shopping center where Martinez worked at a local Walmart. The agents attacked Martinez, threw him to the ground, arrested him as they asked him for proof he was born in the United States. Martinez has since been fired by Walmart. His body's still covered in cuts and bruises. He's wearing a knee brace after being injured by agents in the attack. In California, a bill introduced by two Bay Area lawmakers would force ICE agents and other federal agents to show their faces and identify themselves while making arrests. New York Congresswoman Nydia Velazquez has introduced similar legislation on Capitol Hill. On Wednesday, Attorney General Pam Bondi told lawmakers she was unaware that ICE agents are using masks and hoods to obscure their identity during immigration raids. She was questioned by Michigan Democratic Senator Gary Peters.
They have to identify themselves as law enforcement. People think, here's a person coming up to me, not identified, covering themselves. They're kidnapping. They'll probably fight back. That endangers the officer as well. Someone's going to fight back if you just think a strange person with their face covered throwing you into a van. Most people will resist that.
It sounds like you have a specific case, and I would
be
happy to talk to you about that at a later time because I'm not aware of that happening.
In more immigration news, a federal judge granted a request from the Trump administration to force-feed an Iranian asylum seeker who's on hunger strike while detained at the Florence ICE jail in Arizona. Last month, Mehrat Asadi Edavand was arrested by federal immigration agents outside his home in Phoenix. He's been on two hunger strikes since. In Florida, another person has been reported dead in the custody of ICE. Johnny Noviello, a 49-year-old citizen of Canada, was found unresponsible at the Bureau of Prisons Federal Detention Center in Miami Monday. Noviello is at least the 10th person to die in ICE custody this year. Last week, a 68-year-old Mexican immigrant died while being transported from a local Georgia jail to an ICE detention center. Abelardo Avellaneda Delgado is the first person to die under these circumstances in at least a decade, according to The Guardian, as private companies are tasked with transporting immigrants with little oversight to ensure their safety. In public health news, a U.S. vaccine advisory panel has recommended adults and children no longer receive flu vaccines containing trace amounts of the mercury-containing compound known as thimerosal. That's despite the widespread scientific consensus that the preservative poses no risk to human health and does not cause autism, as a discredited 1998 study claimed. Thursday's decision by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices came after Health and Human Services Secretary RFK Jr. fired the panel's 17 voting members and replaced them with hand-picked appointees, many of them anti-vaxxers. New York City Mayor Eric Adams announced Thursday he's running for re-election in November as an independent. Adams will face front-runner Zoran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist who defeated former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo in Tuesday's Democratic mayoral primary. CNN reports Cuomo will not drop out of the race by today's deadline to remove himself from the general election ballot. Instead, Cuomo's name will appear under a ballot line for a newly created third party named Fight and Deliver. And the legendary journalist Bill Moyers has died at the age of 91. In the 1960s, Moyers was a founding organizer of the Peace Corps, served as press secretary for President Lyndon Johnson. In 1971, he began an award-winning career as a television broadcaster that would last for over 40 years. During that time, Moyers received over 30 Emmys and countless other prizes. He was elected to the Television Hall of Fame in 1995. Bill Moyers was a frequent guest on Democracy Now!, including this appearance in 2011.
Democracy should be a break on unbridled greed and power, because capital, like a fire, can turn from a servant, a good servant, into an evil master. And democracy is the break on my passions and my appetites and your greed and your wealth. And we have to get that equilibrium back.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a 6-3 ruling, the Supreme Court's backed efforts by South Carolina to defund Planned Parenthood by removing its health clinics from the state's Medicaid program. In a dissent joined by her liberal colleagues, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson said the ruling, quote, will strip those South Carolinians and countless other Medicaid recipients around the country of a deeply personal freedom, the ability to decide who treats us at our most vulnerable, unquote. Vicki Ringer of Planned Parenthood South Carolina spoke outside the Supreme Court Thursday.
Now, the governor has said, there's so many other Medicaid providers. We know that's a fallacy. There are not. We have a dire shortage of Medicaid providers. When the governor first issued this executive order in 2018, we scrambled to find other providers who would care for our patients. What we found was there was no one who would see a patient in less than 3 months. Well, if you've got a problem, 3 months is unacceptable. So who are they going to go to? Meanwhile, the state is sending money to these anti-abortion clinics that provide no health care whatsoever. But the main reason that they've done this is clearly political. They want to shut down Planned Parenthood, and they want to have a backdoor ban for abortion.
The ruling comes 3 years after the court overturned Roe v. Wade, eliminating the federal constitutional right to abortion. We're joined now in Washington, D.C. by Rebecca Grant, author and freelance journalist covering reproductive rights, health and justice. Her new book, Just Out, is titled Access, Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. Before we talk about the resistance to what's taken place, I'd like you to respond to the Supreme Court's decision and its significance.
Yeah, I think it is yet another example in a very long line of anti-abortion politicians taking actions that we know will directly harm women and people who can get pregnant, and particularly people who are poor, who are low income, who have very limited options for how else they can access the health care that they so badly need. I mean, South Carolina, as the representative from Planned Parenthood mentioned, I think it's 41 out of 46 counties are considered federally designated health care provider shortage areas. So it's extremely unclear where people need to go. And this is in a state that already has very high rates of maternal mortality and of STIs. And so it's part of this broader effort to cut down on all reproductive health care and not just abortion access.
And talk about what this means for other states around the country. This is South Carolina.
The kind of term that I have been hearing is this idea that it will open the floodgates. There are already a handful of other states that have taken steps to, essentially kick Planned Parenthood off of Medicaid. This is also something that anti-abortion politicians have been trying to do in one form or another since at least 2015. And so I think it's extremely likely that we are going to see many states move to make similar moves or advance the moves that they've already made. And that could result in the closure of hundreds, potentially, of reproductive healthcare clinics. And this is on top of other moves that the administration is making to make this type of healthcare more difficult to access.
In 2023, the first lawsuit after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade was filed by five women who sued Texas after they were denied abortions, even as their pregnancies posed serious risks to their health and were non-viable. This week, 3 years later, about 100, as they call them, abortion storytellers, came to Washington, D.C. to tell their stories. One of them was the plaintiff in that case, Amanda Zurofsky.
I cannot adequately put into words the trauma and despair that comes with waiting to either lose your own life, your child's life, or both. For days, I was locked in this bizarre and avoidable hell. In a matter of minutes, I went from being physically healthy to developing sepsis, a condition in which bacteria in the blood develops into infection with the ability to kill in under an hour.
So that was Amanda Zurofsky, who was speaking then a while ago, but today is in Washington, D.C., telling her story again. Rebecca Grant, this takes us to the resistance. Certainly, Amanda is one of the leaders in that resistance. But you write about this in this remarkable book, Access, Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. Can you talk about, on the one hand, the Supreme Court overturning Roe v. Wade, but the fact that abortions have increased since the overturning of Roe v. Wade? Even in some of the most repressive states when it comes to abortion bans in the country. Explain what's going on.
Yeah, I think that that statistic speaks to the incredible resilience and bravery and, frankly, creativity of the abortion access movement. And so while Dobbs is absolutely, there have been dire consequences, at the same time, I think that there is a way that the movement has stepped up to ensure that anyone who needs an abortion is able to get one. And so some of the reasons for the increase, and by the way, that increase does not include numbers of self-managed abortion, which there is also research showing that those numbers have gone up, that more people are self-managing their abortion, like, outside of the medical or legal system. But I think one of the primary drivers is the accessibility of telemedicine abortion. COVID precipitated some changes in the FDA regulations around mifepristone, which is one of the two drugs of the medication abortion regimen, and said that it could be mailed. And so
Over the past couple years, there have been telehealth providers who are able to evaluate patients online and write prescriptions and send the medication to them to take in their homes. And there are what are known as shield law providers who are clinicians in blue states that have passed these shield law protections who are still serving patients in all 50 states. And so because of the advances in telemedicine, which now make up, I believe, 1 in 5 abortions in the U.S., abortion is more accessible in some ways, in many ways, than it was before the Dobbs decision. I think another factor is the kind of abortion fund ecosystem and the way that they are supporting people traveling out of state. So between 2020 and 2023, the numbers of abortion seekers who have left their state, who have traveled out of state to access care, has doubled. And abortion funds have dispensed tens of millions of dollars to enable them to go access care elsewhere. And so I think that that has been something that's been really powerful and inspiring to see. Because we know throughout history that making abortion illegal or trying to ban it does not make it go away. People will find other ways to access the care that they need. And one of the things that's so powerful about medication abortion and telemedicine is that it means that people kind of have more options than ever to access abortion in a way that is convenient and doesn't necessarily require them to travel out of state. But at the same time, while we know that medication abortion is very safe and effective, and for some people it can be convenient, it's not a good fit for everyone. There will always be people who need or want clinic-based care. And depending on the state that they're in, the legal environment can be really kind of tenuous and risky. And so people are just making the best decisions that they can, the best choices that they can with the resources that are available to them.
We just have a minute to go, but one of the powers of your book, Rebecca, In Access, is the women who are really leaders of the movement. You talked about shield laws. Tell us about Dr. Linda Prine and the fact that it was Brazil women, women in Brazil, who realized that this, that an off-use of the ulcer drug, the medication abortion drugs, was abortion.
Yeah, I mean, the two drugs, both mifepristone and misoprostol. So misoprostol can be used on its own to induce an abortion. And as you said, it was registered as an ulcer medication. And so in the 1980s in Brazil, which had an abortion ban and really high rates of complications and maternal mortality, through word of mouth, women started realizing that they could take this drug like in the community. They could just buy it from local pharmacies and they could safely and effectively end their pregnancies. And I think that there's this really something I try to draw in the book is this connection, this legacy of just individuals and activists over the years who have tried to share this information as broadly and widely and make it as accessible as possible. And I think that Dr. Linda Prine and other shield law providers who have really been incredibly active in trying to carry on that legacy, really, and make medication abortion accessible to people in all 50 states and around the world.
We're going to talk more about these cases and about Dr. Rebecca Gompers, Women Waves, the organization that has fought to get women the medication abortion drugs around the world, especially in places where there are bans on abortion. We're going to talk with Rebecca Grant after the show and post it as a web exclusive online at democracynow.org. Rebecca Grant is author of the new book, Access: Inside the Abortion Underground and the 60-Year Battle for Reproductive Freedom. Her book before that was called Birth. Coming up, the case of Andre José Hernández Romero, a gay makeup artist and asylum seeker from Venezuela, who has spent over 100 days locked up in El Salvador's mega prison, SECAT, after being sent there by the Trump administration. We'll speak with his mother and his best friend. Stay with us.
No es justo nada en la tierra que habitamos, en medio de la... se quedan mudos. Otros tienen memoria para olvidar. Si la violencia es un espejo que se rompe.
Nunca Más by La Santa Cecilia in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. It's Pride Month. This weekend, major celebrations will be taking place all over the country. Well, this week also has marked over 100 days since Andre Jose Hernandez Romero and over 200 others were sent on a plane without warning or due process to El Salvador. They were not deported, but rather sent to El Salvador to be confined in a notorious megaprison known as SECAT, the Terrorism Confinement Center, where they have no ability to communicate with the outside world, including with their families or legal counsel. The Trump administration's paying the Bukele government of El Salvador to hold Andre and the others in SECAT, we believe something like $6 million. While they've been described by the administration as the worst of the worst, in fact, the majority of those sent to SECAT have no serious criminal history. Andre and others have been accused of being a member of the Tren de Aragua gang and sent to El Salvador under the Alien Enemies Act. He's now the lead plaintiff in the case JGG versus Trump, which is seeking the return of Andre and all the men unlawfully sent to El Salvador under this act. Andre is a makeup artist. He came to the U.S. to seek asylum, but he never set foot in the country and never had a chance to plead his case. He was immediately placed in immigration detention here in the U.S., reportedly because of a tattoo he has of a crown. He spent months in detention before he was sent to El Salvador. Andre's family has not heard from him since March, before he boarded the flight. He told his mother he was being flown home to Venezuela. She only found out he was, in fact, in the Salvador prison when he never arrived home. And a week later, saw images on the news from SECAT, including of her son. We're going to go right now to a clip.
He was a soy gay and saying that he was innocent, and he was, you know, being slapped every time he would speak up, but he just, like, he couldn't help himself. Then he started praying and calling out, literally crying for his mother. His crying out for his mother really, you know, touched me.
That was Philip Helsinger, who is a photographer who took a photo of Andres with his hair being cut as he cried out for his mother. We're joined now by Margaret Cargioli, who is representing Andre, as well as eight others as their immigration attorney. She's the directing attorney of the policy and advocacy at Immigrant Defenders Law Center. Thanks for coming in from New Jersey. Explain what's happened. Where is he?
Unfortunately, it's been 105 days since over 200 men, including Andre, were disappeared from the United States to El Salvador and to SECAT. Immigration attorneys have not been able to have any direct contact with Andre. His family was not able to see him, and they've not been able to speak with him directly since they were sent there. We have been fighting in immigration court to keep his case alive, but unfortunately, in many of these cases, the immigration judges have dismissed their cases, essentially closing them, even though we've argued that their due process rights were violated. They were in the middle of their immigration proceedings, and these cases should continue to stay alive because they should be returned to have their right to defend their cases, seek asylum, and keep their temporary protective status, for example.
I want to go to Andre's mother and his best friend. On Wednesday evening, Democracy Now! Reached Andre Hernandez Romero's mother, Alexis Romero, and his best friend, Reina Cardenas. They were speaking from Andre's hometown in Venezuela of Capacho. Reina went with some people recently, family members of those held in SECAT, to El Salvador to try to meet with Andres, but They were denied that ability. Dina filed a petition to visit Andriy, languishing in Sakat without any communication for over 3 months now. Her petition denied. Andriy's loved ones continue to demand for his release and immediate proof he's still alive, and they haven't been able to speak to him since he was put on that plane from Texas to El Salvador.
My son is everything to me. He is a young man who is very introverted, a person who loves to learn, who loves to help other people. He is a homebody and 100% supportive of his dad, his brother, and me, his mom. Andriy last called me on March 14th at 6:30 in the afternoon, telling me he was coming home, that they were going to transfer him to another detention center in Texas, where the plane was going to bring them to Venezuela. The plane was carrying all of the other innocent young men. But the plane didn't come here. It was sent to El Salvador. I found out my son was there the following Thursday. From then on, our lives changed. We were so happy waiting for him to come home so that all of his trauma would end. Instead, everything got worse.
Andriy and I were in touch when he was in detention in the United States. He basically never entered the U.S. He was detained from the moment he showed up for his asylum appointment. That's when this process began. One day he called me and said, Reina, they're linking me to Tren de Aragua. I need you to get me photos. All the documentation from the three wise men because of the crowns. I sent these documents and evidence so that he could defend himself, something U.S. authorities never gave him the right to do. He never had due process. I've known Andriy since we were kids. I'm older than him. I'm 36 and he's 32. We've been neighbors for over 20 years. We also have relatives in common. We spent so much time together. We drank coffee. We went out to dinner. We would hang out here at my house. He did my makeup. He was my confidant, and I was his confidant. We had a very close relationship, more than a friendship, like siblings. We also worked for the same Three Wise Men Foundation, where Andriy has been an actor for 25 years. This is the festivity, the Capacho Three Kings Foundation, which has been in existence for 108 years. We are part of the artistic, cultural, and religious heritage of the municipality, this state, and Venezuela. It has a long history, and Andriy has participated as an actor since he was 7 years old. He has participated as an actor, stylist, makeup artist, and costume designer. If we don't fight for him, who will? This is all so painful. We need Andriy to know that he is not alone.
When my son left to the United States, he would tell me and his dad that he's going to help us and that he would make his dream come true to have his own salon. And they thwarted all of that. They stepped on him, ran him over, completely shut down his dream. Now, what is my boy going to do? My message to Andriy is that I love him, that I want him to come home, that I want him to be strong. He is a warrior. His dad, his brother, and I are eagerly waiting for him. We are doing everything in our power to bring him home.
And the United States government claims to be law-abiding, democratic, and committed to justice and the law, but it isn't. There is no evidence that this is happening.
That was Reina Cárdenas, Andriy's best friend, and Alexis Romero, his mother, speaking from their hometown of Capacho in Venezuela. Speaking to Democracy Now! Is Maria Inez Taracena and Nicole Salazar. Special thanks. We are in the studio with Andriy's lawyer, Margaret Cargioli. How is this possible? The tattoos that supposedly the Trump administration has used. He was in a legal process in this Trump detention center seeking asylum. There is a tattoo on either hand of mom and dad, and they have a crown, as just described, because he lives in this town of king pageantry.
Yeah, so unfortunately, in many of these cases, because of having just benign tattoos, tattoos that many people have, such as a crown that says mom or dad, they accused him of being part of Trindaragua. They presented no other records, no criminal records, no arrest records, just photos that they assume are connected to Trindaragua.
So explain what the judge has said in this case, Judge Boasberg.
Yeah, so in the JGG versus Trump case, it's a federal court case. Recently, Judge Boasberg said that the men's rights were violated when they were sent to El Salvador and that the United States government needs to facilitate their due process rights. They need to present evidence as to how they're going to give them right, for example, to habeas. We believe that they need to be returned to the United States in order to be afforded those rights.
And his best friend, Reina, just tried to get to see him in El Salvador and couldn't, along with other relatives. She was denied.
Yes, unfortunately, their family, friends, attorneys have had no direct access to any of the men that were sent to CECOT. You know, it's extremely concerning and alarming because we are not getting any information as to what's happening to their in their daily lives, as to their conditions. We know that Matt Gaetz recently went.
Matt Gaetz, the former disgraced congressman.
Correct. Went
now to, a podcaster.
Yes, went to CECOT. Walk through while these men were pleading for their freedom, making universal hand signals, SOS signals, asking for help, saying they were kidnapped. And he just walks through with other representatives. And that is the only video footage that we've seen of some of these men, including one
and
of our clients.
Why did Andri seek asylum here? Going through the correct process.
Yes, Andri last entered the United States with a CBP-1 appointment. He sought asylum because he was persecuted due to his political opinion and because he's LGBTQ+. He had the right to seek asylum in the United States.
I mean, the endless pictures of him as a hairdresser with models and that he so proudly put online.
Yes, you know, in the reports that have come out about many of these men, you know, their parents have shown photos to evidence who they were, where they worked. These are real human beings who we know have no criminal records, no ties to Trindaragua, but they've been silenced, purposefully silenced by the United States government.
We're about to go to the former head of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, Pramila Jayapal. She is standing by in Washington. But I want to ask you about one more of a number of your clients, and that is Miguel. Where is he?
Miguel Rojas Mendoza is one of our clients. He had a hearing yesterday where I represented him virtually at immigration court. For the second time at a hearing where I asked exactly where he was deported, the government has told me that they cannot provide it. They confirmed he was removed from the United States, but refused to say exactly where he is. I asked the immigration judge.
He doesn't have a criminal record.
Correct. He has no convictions. He was apparently accused of Trindaragua because he also has benign tattoos. And in many of these cases, the government is seeking to dismiss them, close their immigration cases.
But explain, you're having a hearing in court yesterday, and they would not say where they sent this man to?
It is almost incredible to believe that yesterday in a United States immigration court hearing, I had to ask for these details and it was not provided to me. I was told that I need to send an email, was provided an email address where I could try to obtain more information.
About where Miguel was sent to?
About where, what country he was sent to.
But they admit that they kidnapped him, that they took him and sent him out of the country.
They did finally in this court hearing admit that he was removed. You know, it is quite astonishing that in the United States, people are being disappeared in this manner, and we're continuing to see these egregious immigration policies taking place all throughout the country, where people are literally being kidnapped and families cannot find where their loved ones are.
Margaret Cargillo, I want to thank you for being with us. We'll be in touch with you again, Directing Attorney of Policy and Advocacy at Immigrant Defenders Law Center, joining us here in New York. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. As we turn now to the continuing crackdown on immigrants by the Trump administration. Just this week, it's been reported the administration plans to dismiss potentially hundreds of thousands of open asylum cases. Those targeted are anyone who entered the U.S. unlawfully rather than at a port of entry before applying for asylum. This would essentially shut down all possibilities of claiming asylum along the southern border. President Trump's already made it effectively impossible to make an asylum claim at ports of entry on the border the day he took office. Critics say these restrictions on asylum are flagrantly illegal. Also this week, the Supreme Court cleared the way for the administration to send deportees to third countries rather than their own. This ruling stems from a case last month in which the government tried to send a plane of immigrants, mostly Latin American and Asian, to South Sudan. The flight was diverted to a military base in Djibouti. A lower court had said deportees should have a right to challenge their deportation to third countries. Other countries that have been approached by the administration to take U.S. deportees include Ukraine and Libya. And the administration may add more than 36 countries to the blanket travel ban already in effect for 12 nations if certain conditions are not met. 25 of the 36 countries are in Africa. For more on these developments and more, we're joined from the Capitol by Congressmember Pramila Jayapal of Washington State. She's the ranking member of the Subcommittee on Immigration Integrity, Security Enforcement, begun holding a series of shadow hearings on Trump's immigration actions, most recently on what she calls third country disappearances and the weaponization of the immigration court. Why don't you, Congressmember Jayapal, take it from there? The weaponization of the immigration court and what these third country disappearances are.
Yeah, thanks so much, Amy, for covering this, as you always do. Look, this is an attack by the Trump administration on every part of the legal immigration system as we know it. And so the third country removals is the attempt of the administration to deport people to third countries without any due process. And once they are on a flight, obviously, they then claim that they can't get those people back. And so this had been upheld by lower courts that this was unconstitutional, illegal for the government to do, because due process, as you know, is one of those clauses in the Constitution that's very clear. It doesn't say for citizens, it says for everybody. And so the government was losing in a number of lower courts, but then the Supreme Court, it got to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court, as you said, just announced that it was actually okay for the government to do this. And we have been trying to shine a light on the Immigration Subcommittee. We're in the minority, obviously, so we can't do official hearings. But I've started doing a series of shadow hearings to shine a light on all of the ways that the government is attacking immigrants and the legal immigration system. The first one was on third country deportations. The whole series is called Kidnapped and Disappeared. The second one, which we did yesterday, was exactly on what the attorney for Andre was just talking about, the fact that now what the government is doing is they have been dismissing cases when somebody shows up to be in compliance with the immigration system. They have appointments for citizenship. They have appointments for asylum court cases. In some cases, immigrants have been waiting for years to go through this process. They finally, imagine what it's like when you finally get your appointment. You show up to your appointment and the government dismisses the case. Now, typically when the government has dismissed a case, it's because they decide they're not going to pursue it anymore. In this case, the government is dismissing the case so that then as the person walks out of immigration court, they can be arrested, detained, and deported, again with no due process. And so this is a remarkable attack on the idea that immigrants should show up for their court cases. And it's a real catch-22, because if you show up you could get detained and deported, arrested, detained and deported. If you don't show up, then you are now in violation of your of the immigration regulations, and you're deemed as an absconder. The reason they are trying to dismiss these cases is because once a case is dismissed, they can then put an immigrant into what's called expedited removal. Expedited removal means that you don't get due process. Now, there is a small provision where you can still make a case that if you're going to be deported back to your home country where you're going to be tortured, that theoretically there should be a process where you can challenge it again, which is the most inefficient thing because that's why you were in court to start with. But we know that that very small ability to challenge in a case of expedited removal is non-existent. So all of this to say that the government is using every way, whether it's cracking down on free speech, as we've seen with Mahmoud Khalil and Rumeysa Ozturk, whether it's cracking down and using this wartime authority of the Alien Enemies Act, that was a law from 1798 that essentially says if there's an invasion, then the government can deport people. And what they're now saying is that these Andriy, other members, Arturo, a number of others, where the evidence is mainly these tattoos that are not related to gangs at all, these individuals can be deported. Venezuelans can be deported to El Salvador, to CICOT, and not have any due process. And
very quickly,
we're just trying to shine a light on this.
Congressman Jayapal, we have 30 seconds. The budget. Talk about the votes that's taken place and the decision of the parliamentary and the Senate to strike down parts of it.
Yeah, well, there's a 60-vote threshold in the Senate for anything related to policy if you use a budget reconciliation bill. And so the parliamentarian has said that you can't, for example, tell states that they can't have a Medicaid provider tax. You can't say that states can't use their own money to provide Medicaid to immigrants of all legal statuses. You can't sell off millions of acres of public lands. These are some of the provisions that have been taken out of the Big Bad Betrayal Bill, which, just to remind people, kicks 16 million Americans off of health care and cuts SNAP benefits by $300 billion.
Congressmember Pramila Jayapal, I know you have a briefing you have to go to. I want to thank you for being with us as we go now to a break, and then we remember Bill Moyers in his own words.
I wanna go all over the world and start living free. I know that there's somebody who is waiting.
Dear Someone by Lila Downs. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. The legendary journalist Bill Moyers has died at the age of 91. In the 60s, he was a founding organizer of the Peace Corps, served as press secretary for President Lyndon Johnson. In 1971, began an award-winning career as a TV broadcaster that would last for over 40 years. During that time, Bill Moyers received over 30 Emmys, countless other prizes, many first programs on PBS, also a longtime champion of public television and independent media. His death coming at a time when the Trump administration is moving to strip federal funding from PBS and NPR. In 2011, Juan Gonzalez and I interviewed Bill Moyers. He outlined his critique of the corporate media.
Well, the consensual seduction of the mainstream media by and with the government is one of the most dangerous toxins at work in America today. They wouldn't see it this way, and there are exceptions, but the corruption of corporate media, corporate power, and government is what makes so vital what the two of you do. I'm serious about that. You don't have the scope of Meet the Press. I mean, look at Meet the Press. Who's been on Meet the Press more than any other figure in Washington in the last several years? Newt Gingrich. Newt Gingrich, I later learned when I was briefly at NBC as an analyst doing commentaries, controversial commentaries, actually came to the brass of NBC and GE. Newt Gingrich has had some nefarious relationship with General Electric, which is one of the huge government contractors, as well as the owner of Meet the Press. And it's just an example of what I'm talking about, the consensual seduction of the mainstream media with power, corporate power, government power, with exceptions, I repeat, is something that without the antidote of independent reporting and analysis that you do and others, we would be in a dark, dark pit with no light shining on us.
I want to go back, since we're talking about broadcasting, right back to the Johnson era and then jump back to here, which is about the founding of public broadcasting and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, especially for young people, to understand why it began and where it's gone.
Well, there were three—believe it or not, I mean, nobody below 40 will believe this. You may not believe it, because both of you are much younger than I am. But when I was 20 years old, there were three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And ABC was only half a network, no news division, all of that. And so we were dependent upon three corporate, advertising-driven, commercial networks for our information. And to his credit, Lyndon Johnson, who made his fortune, part of his fortune, by controlling the three. He had one station in Austin that had a monopoly over broadcasting the product, the content of all three networks. I mean, that's how he made his money, much of his money. But he really did believe. He was a teacher. He had taught poor Mexican students in the little town of Cotulla, Texas. He was a populist from a poor part of
South Texas.
Yeah, but he went to South. He came from Central Texas, went to South Texas to teach in this Mexican school. And he really cared about poor, and he cared about education. He felt there should be one channel that was free of commercials and free of commercial values, because he knew what commercial values will do to people who are reporting the news, producing content. The desire to amuse and entertain will cause us to compromise the truth. So he, when the Carnegie Corporation and the Carnegie Commission, John Gardner had been head of the Carnegie Corporation, and they did a study of what to do about educational television in this country. The report was actually delivered to my desk when I was still at the White House. The Carnegie Commission became the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. And I wish we had it here, because the speech Lyndon Johnson made when he signed the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967 is a great tribute to a network devoted to the life of the mind, the life of the spirit, and the diversity of American voices. He believed that only white, male, straight guys got on national television in those days, and he was right. And he saw the value, the changes coming in America, and he believed there should be a public media that was devoted to the diversity, the pluralism of American life, and to the highest expression of the creative and journalistic arts.
And the actual act of the creating the Corporation for Public Television talked about serving underserved communities of America.
And unfortunately, as you probably noticed, that there was a report done by Fairness and Accuracy in Media, a public interest group. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting,
Fair.
And they show that even on public broadcasting today, in our mainstream broadcast, it's usually the official view of reality that's represented. Far more corporate spokesmen than labor or working people spokesmen. Far more white male figures of authority than people of color and marginalized people. That's just a tendency of human beings that always has to be resisted. And public television, public radio belongs to the people. Go back and read a great document, the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. And when we stray from it, as we sometimes do, the public has to rise up and say, we own you, we are your shareholders, come back to first principles, come back to first things.
So what has happened to public broadcasting right now? The onslaught. You talk about You just wrote a piece about NPR and PBS, and you talk about, well, Nixon first tried to gut it and then take it forward.
Richard Nixon tried to—he did succeed in fragmenting our authority, because he didn't like—I was on the air, Robert McNeil was on the air, we were doing journalist work, but he called us liberals because we were trying to get at the facts. He and Pat Buchanan, his communications director, succeeded in harming, injuring public broadcasting back in the 1970s. Thanks to a great Republican who was chairman of the public television station in Dallas, we beat him off. They wanted to defund us completely, but they didn't. Then Newt Gingrich comes along, Robert Dole comes along with the right wing in the late 80s, and he tries to defund public broadcasting. Then comes Newt Gingrich in 1994, and now we had George W. Bush and his team who came after some of us on public broadcasting. Conservatives, on principle, don't believe that federal funds should be used to support the media. But then also they don't believe in allowing any alternative voices, any alternatives to the official view of reality to be heard. So they have always been against public broadcasting. And sometimes self-censorship occurs because you're looking over your shoulder and you think, well, if I do this story or that story, it'll hurt public broadcasting. Public broadcasting has suffered often for my sins, reporting stories the officials don't want reported. And today, only about a very small percentage of funding for NPR and PBS comes from the government, but that accounts for a concentration of pressure and self-censorship. And only when we get a trust fund, only when the public figures out how to support us independently of the federal treasury, will we flourish as an independent media.
Are you hopeful these days, despite the what we've discussed about the state of the media? We've obviously seen these enormous uprisings throughout the Arab world. On Democracy Now, we've covered the democratic popular renaissance that's occurred throughout all of Latin America in recent years, that there are parts of the world where things are hopeful. But right here at home in the United States, things don't always seem like they're heading in a good direction.
I think this country is in a very precarious state at the moment. I think, as I say, the escalating, accumulating power of organized wealth is snuffing out everything public, whether it's public broadcasting, public schools, public unions, public parks, public highways. Everything public has been under assault since the late 1970s, the early years of the Reagan administration, because there is a philosophy that's been extant in America for a long time that anything public is less desirable than the public than private. So I think we're at a very critical moment in the equilibrium. No society, no human being can survive without balance, without equilibrium. Nothing in excess, the ancient Greeks said. And Madison, one of the great framers of our Constitution, built equilibrium into our system. We don't have equilibrium now. The power of money trumps the power of democracy today, and I'm very worried about it. I said to her, and if we don't address this, if we don't get a handle on what we were talking about, money in politics, and find a way to thwart it, tame it, we're into democracy should be a brake on unbridled greed and power, because capital, like a fire, can turn from a servant, a good servant, into an evil master. And democracy is the brake on my passions and my appetites and your greed and your wealth. And we have to get that equilibrium back. I said to a friend of mine on Wall Street, how do you feel about the market? He said, well, I'm optimistic. And I said, why do you then look so worried? And he said, because I'm not sure my optimism is justified. And I feel that way. So I fall back on the balance wheel in the Italian political scientist Gramsci, who said that he practices the pessimism of the mind and the optimism of the will. By that he meant he sees the world as it is, without rose-colored glasses, as I try to do as a journalist. I see what's there. That will make you pessimistic. But then you have to exercise your will optimistically, believing that each of us singly and all of us collectively can be an agent of change. And I have to get up every morning and imagine a more confident future and then try to do something that day to help bring it about.
The legendary Bill Moyers in 2011. He's died at the age of 91. Deepest condolences to his family. I'm Amy Goodman.